This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
So I'm here today with Professor Mike Barlow from UCL, and your research focuses on evolved stars and supernovae, so stars that are at the end of their lives. So can we start off by talking about supernovae and the reasons that you got into studying these objects?
Well, we've been trying to determine whether or not supernovae, in particular supernovae from massive stars at the end of their lives, whether those are creating large quantities of dust or not during the explosion.
So when we say dust, is this dust like you find on Earth, or is this different kind of...
Yeah, it's similar. It's small particles of silicates or carbon or other solid materials. In fact, the Earth itself is made up of what were originally interstellar dust particles, which agglomerated during the formation of the solar system. So we can look out there and we see abundant evidence for there being dust particles everywhere in our galaxy, and in fact everywhere in the universe.
Okay, and this dust is, you think, formed from supernovae?
Well, our past picture of where the dust came from was that it was formed around outflows from cool stars. These are M supergiants like Alpha Orionis, Betelgeuse. It produces dust in its outflow. Or evolved what we call red giant stars, AGB stars. And examples of that are Mara Ceti, which is a pulsating variable star, or a famous carbon star called CW Leo, which is optically invisible, but it's the brightest star in the sky at near-infrared wavelengths. So we've known for quite some time that these stars at the endpoints of their lives gently make dust particles. And the picture we had was that they were the dominant sources of dust in our galaxy. But we've had to modify our views by the fact that when we look out to very high redshifts, this is where we're getting light coming from way back towards the beginning of the universe, we detect galaxies in the process of forming, which are emitting very strongly in infrared and submillimeter. And that emission comes from absorption of starlight by dust particles and re-emission in the infrared. And it was a bit of a surprise that we found so strong infrared emission going back to the first scuba detections more than 10 years ago. The model up until then was that the first stars contained very little in the way of heavy elements and therefore very little dust particles which are made of heavy elements. But what we're finding and what people have been finding is that there are very large quantities of dust in these galaxies. And yet, some of them were formed only 500 million years after the Big Bang. So that's led to people thinking, well, at such early stages in the universe, low-mass stars like the Sun would not have had time to evolve to become a red giant. And the only stars which would evolve quickly enough are high-mass stars, stars with masses 10, 20, 30 times the mass of the Sun. And those stars have a completely different endpoint of the revolution. They explode as supernovae.
So maybe we should take a step back and actually explain what a supernova is.
Okay, well, there are two types of supernovae. Type 1A supernovae, which come from quite low-mass stars. They're binary systems. They explode. They have a very predictable maximum light, and they're used a lot for cosmological studies of the expansion of the universe because they're standard candles. But the type we're talking about today are type 2 supernovae, which are also called core collapse supernovae. And this is when a star of high mass, more than 10 solar masses, has exhausted all its nuclear fuel and it can no longer support itself against gravity. At that point, it collapses just into a very dense core. There's a bounce and the star explodes and leaves nothing. Well, it leaves a pulsar behind. And of course, here at Manchester, pulsar studies are very prominent. They're looking at the small remnant left by the core collapse supernova. But most of the mass that was in the star has been ejected into the interstellar medium.
So how do you find supernovae? Is it a case of monitoring certain galaxies to find these brightness, or is it just by luck?
You find them in nearby galaxies by monitoring. There are more and more programs where they have wide-field monitoring, imaging of the sky. They observe large parts of the sky every night and compare them with previous images of the field in computational space. And then they will pick out supernovae. But it's a hit or miss. We're not catching every supernova at present. But every year there are more and more supernovae being reported. So the studies that we're doing are looking at nearby supernovae to see whether these nearby supernovae are producing quantities of dust that we infer must be needed in the faraway galaxies in order to explain how much dust is present in those galaxies.
So nearby supernovae, is that in our galaxy or in some galaxies close
by? No, the last supernova that went off in our own galaxy was 400 years ago.
Wow.
A big spiral galaxy like our own ought to produce a supernova about every 30 or 40 years. And yet, in Milky Way, we had about three between about 1570 and 1700. Tycho's supernova, Kepler's supernova, and a famous radio source called Cassia, which is inferred to have gone off around about the 1680s. But since then, there's been recently a report that a supernova towards the galactic center is expanding at a rate which implies that it went off at about 1890. Wow. But there was so much obscuration between us and that region that it was never seen. Similarly with Cassia, it was never seen by anybody at the time because there was a lot of interstellar dust obscuration.
That's impressive that we can still see these supernovae so long after they've gone off.
Yes. And in fact, there was a recent paper published in Nature where they used the light echoes propagating through the interstellar medium in order to infer what class of supernova Cassia was. This is because the interstellar medium is full of gas and dust. When you have a bright flash, the flash propagates through the interstellar medium and some fraction of it gets reflected off the dust particles in the interstellar medium and towards us. Very, very faint. But if you use a large telescope and take a long, deep spectrum of one of these light echoes, you can actually pick up the faint echo of the original explosion of the supernova. So you get a spectrum of the supernova 400 years after it happened.
Oh.
And they did this on Cassia, and they found it was a type 2 supernova, as people had expected.
So supernovae have a quite distinct spectrum. That's how you distinguish them
from
other...
Yeah, they have very broad emission lines because the gas is expanding so fast. It broadens the lines that are present, and they're unmistakable when you get a supernova spectrum.
You said that the Milky Way has quite a low supernova rate.
Yeah, well, we think maybe we're missing a lot of them because of obscuring dust. We're sitting here in the plane of our galaxy, and when we look towards the rest of the Milky Way, unless we're within a few thousand light years, then the obscuration by dust can be quite significant. The stuff on the far side of the galaxy is going to be missed entirely, and there are many regions in the plane like Cygnus or the southern regions of the galaxy, where we might just miss a supernova. We think that it should be producing a supernova once every 50 years, but we're not catching them all.
Do you find more supernovae in spiral or elliptical galaxies?
Well, it depends what type of supernova. I mentioned the type 1A supernova, cosmic candles. They come from both ellipticals and spirals because they're low-mass stars. And elliptical galaxies contain lots of low-mass stars. But ellipticals don't have high-mass stars anymore. They've finished that stage of their evolution. And we don't find type 2 supernova, the core collapse type. They only come from spiral galaxies and from what we call dwarf irregular galaxies.
And I know that you've been involved with Herschel, the Herschel Space Telescope, and those results were first released in December, I think, to the public. So now we can finally talk about some Herschel science, if you can.
The European Space
Agency
had embargoed the reporting of results until they could present them all in one place. And they did that in Madrid just before Christmas. And there was a two-day meeting where many new Herschel results were presented. And there were a lot of very spectacular results being reported. Ourselves, we presented some results on supernovae. We're studying, in fact, Cassia with Herschel, and we're getting images of it with two of the instruments that are on board Herschel. One is called PAX, which is a imaging spectrometer, which covers the far infrared region. And the other is called SPIRE, which is a UK-led instrument, which covers the region starting at 200 microns and going out to 650 microns.
So microns, these are micrometers.
These are wavelengths of the radiation.
Yeah.
We also call that the microwave or submillimeter region. At the end, round about a millimeter, is the region where your microwave in the kitchen is emitting strongly. but we're looking at somewhat shorter wavelengths than that. So we imaged Cassiopeia A at six different wavelengths, and we formed a picture of what's happening. The reason that we're interested in Cass A is it's a nearby supernova remnant. It's only 10,000 light years away. And we want to find out whether there are new dust particles present in the supernova that were synthesized during the expansion of the ejecta. Because as the ejecta from the supernova expands, it also cools. And at some point, the gas can become cool enough and clumpy enough that you can get small dust particles condensing within it. So the sort of the big question is, are there large quantities of dust particles large enough to explain what's happening in the early universe, or are they just producing small quantities of dust particles? Well, we're not yet finally there. We only obtained the most recent set of data 2 weeks before Christmas, and we're currently heavily involved in analyzing the data sets. So we've been able to show the images, but the quantitative analysis is still underway. So I can't yet tell you whether or not there are large quantities or small quantities, but hopefully within the next couple of months we'll be able to provide an answer to that.
What's the advantage of using different wavelengths with Herschel?
Well, Herschel looks at regions where you're completely unobscured by dust, but it's also regions where, as I mentioned, dust particles re-emit radiation that they're absorbing in the ultraviolet and the optical. So we're getting a completely transparent view of the universe, but we're also seeing one of its dominant components, which is the dust component of the universe. There are two types of interstellar matter. One is gas particles like hydrogen, helium, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. And the other is where some of the heavy elements like oxygen, silicon, iron, carbon have condensed into small particles. Well, gas can be quite elusive when you're trying to measure how much is present. If it decides not to emit, if there's no excitation mechanism, you can have a great deal of difficulty in determining how much gas is present. But dust particles really can't hide from you. They absorb optical or ultraviolet radiation, and they'll always then re-emit in the infrared. And so you'll always detect them when you go to the infrared or submillimeter wavelengths. So you can always determine exactly how much dust is present. And that's not always the case for gas. So that's why we're drawn to measure dust, because it's ubiquitous, it's everywhere, and it emits strongly. I could also mention the observations we've been doing with the Spitzer Space Observatory on supernovae.
Yep.
2 days after Herschel was launched on May the 16th, the Spitzer Space Observatory used up the last of its liquid helium. It had been launched by NASA in 2003, and it was another infrared observatory, but observing at slightly shorter wavelengths, going from about 3 microns to 160 microns, whereas Herschel starts at 70 microns and goes to longer wavelengths. So they're very complementary, but unfortunately they didn't overlap in time. But with Spitzer, we were studying supernovae that had gone off in nearby galaxies, and we were observing the first few thousand days after they were exploding, in order to see whether there was real-time evidence of new dust particles appearing. And indeed, we did see in quite a few supernovae, after about 300 or 400 days, we began to see the telltale signatures of dust emission at near-infrared and mid-infrared wavelengths. So we could confirm that supernovae were making dust, and we could also measure how much dust those new supernovae were making. In about 50% of the cases, we found that a few hundredths of a solar mass, maybe, or a few thousandths of a solar mass, were being made by the supernovae. But interestingly, it's tantalizingly close to explaining how much dust we see in the early universe, but not quite enough. So our current view is that if supernovae in young galaxies are similar to the ones that we see in nearby galaxies today, then massive star supernovae may not be the source of the dust particles that we see in those galaxies.
Do you have any idea what else could be forming this dust?
Not really. it's a bit of a mystery. There are precursor stages to massive star supernovae. By precursor, I mean the stage of evolution immediately before the star explodes, where we think that extensive mass loss may be occurring. And there's a few objects in our own galaxy which are in this phase. There's one famous object called Eta Carinae, which is believed to be a star with a mass of about 150 solar masses, which is very strongly emitting in the infrared because it had a big outburst in 1848 where it ejected a shell of dust and gas, which was sufficiently massive to obscure the star itself. So Eta Carinae rose to become a third magnitude object in 1848. It was brighter than that. It became a first magnitude object. And it was one of the brightest stars in the Southern Hemisphere for about 10 or 20 years. But then the shell that it was ejected, the dust in it began to obscure the star, and it faded to fainter than 6th magnitude.
Do you know what the limit is that the human eye could see?
Human eye can see in a very dark site down to about 6th magnitude.
Okay.
But today, Eta Carinae is beginning a slow rise again because the shell of dust that it ejected is expanding, and as it expands, the obscuration is decreasing very gradually. So it's beginning a slow recovery back to the brightness it might have had before the 1848 event.
That's very impressive that you can kind of use data from 1848.
Yes. There was a famous astronomer called John Herschel, who was based down in Cape Town during that period, who followed the evolution of the outburst in great detail. So we have a great deal of information about the 1848 outburst. There was a further one in the 1860s, I believe, but not quite as bright as the 1848.
Oh. Well, it sounds like you're working in a very fascinating field, and thank you for taking time to talk to us about it.
Okay, well, thank you.